We are in John 13. If you were here last week, we began John 13, 1, and it is what's called the Upper Room Discourse. This is the longest section of Jesus' personal teaching with his disciples in all four Gospels. So we get like this personal front row scene, courtesy of John, who was there, who was the youngest of the disciples, writing this account down and giving it to us. There are experiences and moments that are sort of hinted at or shown in the other Gospels, but in John, he actually gives us teaching that none of the other Gospels give us. And this section is really introduced with verse 1 of chapter 13, I think is the controlling theme for this whole section at least. Verse 1, when Jesus knew that his hour had come to depart out of this world to the Father, having loved his own who were in the world, he loved them to the end. So the first part of this chapter introduces the idea that this is love, Jesus loving his disciples. And then what happens is this beautiful, beautiful experience that really is, I think, maybe the most beautiful, intimate, personal, humble picture of Jesus apart from the cross. And that is what was called, what is known as the sort of foot washing, or Jesus washing his disciples' feet. In our culture, it's hard for us to understand the implications there, but in this culture, people would, you'd come into the household, and if you were a guest, you had been wearing open, you know, shoes all day and walking the streets, and you can just imagine how much on dry days, how much dust gets on there, how on wet days, how much dust, dirt, and other things get on your feet. And they walked roads where animals were defecating, and it was just a pretty gross thing. Everyone's feet was kind of gross, like kind of like now. Nobody's like, you know, yeah, feet are really clean. So nobody thinks a feet is clean here. Imagine how much worse then. So when it came time, you came into the household, the lowest servant couldn't even be a Jewish servant, had to be a Gentile servant, would wash the feet of whoever was the guest in the home. And it would happen, you'd be eating and you would be reclining at a table, and this wasn't the normal way they ate all the time, but when you had a feast or an event, you kind of reclined at the table on your left shoulder, your feet would be back behind you, and you would be reaching with your right hand to eat. And so you can imagine that context. You could, as I shared last week, you could ignore whoever was washing your feet because they were the lowest servant. Well, Jesus, after they ate, decided to get up. He took off his outer robe. He put on the form of the lowest servant in the household, wrapped himself with the towel, grabbed the basin, and washed all of the disciples' feet. And then that included Judas, but also Simon, Peter, who... Typical Simon Peter did not understand what was happening, but as soon as he did, then when Jesus said, "No, I'm washing your whole, this is a symbol of me cleaning you," he's like, "Okay, wash my whole body. Let's do a bath right here." You know, he was just very eager when he understood what Jesus was doing, but Jesus was like, "No, let's just stick to the symbolism here. I'm washing the dirtiest part of your body to demonstrate you are clean now." And then after this event, after he had loved his disciples in this very tender moment, and having acknowledged Judas would betray him, Judas left, and then Jesus pulls his disciples in for this commandment in verses 34 and 35. "A new commandment I give to you, that you love one another. Just as I have loved you, you also are to love one another. By this, all people will know that you are my disciples, if you have love for one another." Now, that term love is really misunderstood in our context and culture. People, you know, love a pizza. People love the Red Sox. People love their girlfriend or boyfriend. People love what they're doing in their job. And this idea of love, there's a reason the Greeks had multiple words for what, depending on what type of love you were talking about. We just use the word love very generically. And in our culture, it can mean a lot of different things, but largely about primarily about romantic or familial relationships. And then love as a feeling, right? Like, I feel love. And that determines whether it's love, because it's a feeling. And then on the flip side, whether I feel loved by you determines whether you're loving or not. And that means, love means affirming or approving of a person's feelings or thoughts or perceptions, no matter what they are. And people fall in and out of love in our culture. And it was the same as the Roman Empire. There was a lot of misunderstanding about what love was, which is why Jesus didn't just leave it, "Hey, guys, just love one another, okay? Cool. Love wins. Love covers it all. Let's just love, right?" I would argue that that's at least among sort of the most thoughtful people in our culture, that's kind of their point, right? We should just love each other, right? Like, they get that, but there's no definition of it. There's no clarity around that. Jesus doesn't leave it open. Look, he gives one extremely important condition here. Just as I have loved you, you also are to love one another, which means I don't get to determine what love is. Jesus has determined what love is. In fact, in 1 John, which I'd never heard this, I'll be honest with you, I'd never heard this. John Piper, I was listening to him on this text this week, and he actually said, I think, and he makes an argument from it, that 1 John is just a commentary on the commandment, love one another as I've loved you. That all of 1 John, the entire letter, is just a commentary on that commandment. And he makes a pretty good argument for it. But Jesus is the one that determines love. And if you remember from 1 John, I shared this last week, it says God is love, which means I don't determine what love is. You don't determine what love is. God has determined what love is. Why? Because God is the very, love is the very essence of God. You and I would not even know what love is apart from God. So the question in this, I want us to interrogate this passage or look at this passage with is, how has Jesus loved the disciples, or how does his love demonstrate the character we need in our love? And so we're gonna look at these quickly. The first is, the character of Jesus's love is seen in his relationship with Judas. I think John's highlighting this through this entire chapter. I talked a little bit about it briefly last week, but if you're new, Judas is one of the 12 disciples, right? He is one of the ones picked by Jesus. He walked with Jesus day in and day out. He heard all of Jesus' teachings. He was actually trusted to carry the money bag, which, let's face it, when it comes time for 12 people to decide who's going to carry the money bag, do you pick like, hey, that kind of guy's kind of sketchy, let's let him carry it? No, who do you pick? You pick the person you trust. He's good with money, right? Like, he's a trustworthy guy. Let's have Judas do it. That tells you the esteem that they had for him and how he was perceived by the other disciples. Jesus had just washed Judas's feet. And the best we can tell from the arrangement and language of what happens in this text, where he hands a morsel to Judas, right? If you already heard that, he dips when John asks Jesus, who is it? Jesus says, well, it's the one I'm going to dip a morsel of bread and hand it to. Well, it had to be somebody really close to him, right? If you're at a table with 12 people, you can't be like getting up and going, you know, like this. It was so nonchalant that it didn't draw any attention except for the fact. So, well, most scholars believe that Judas was to Jesus's left in the seat of honor. To his right was his beloved young disciple, his little brother, John, right? Like this young man in the Lord who was following him and who he loved. And then to his left was Judas. No one suspected him. One reason for that is that to take a morsel and from the table for the head or host to do it and dip it in a common dish and offer it to someone was a sign of honor. Sign of respect, of special friendship. So when Jesus explained to them that one of them was a traitor and they began to argue and question, no one suspected Judas. Even after John said, who's it gonna be? And he's like, it's the guy I hand this morsel to. And John's like, and the disciples continued to wonder, you know, who could it be? Just know, that's how far it was, how far the idea that Judas could betray Jesus. Yet Jesus knew. Jesus, I believe, kept the door open for Judas, even though he knew Judas would not be saved. He chose to love the man that would betray him to be murdered within a few hours. If I knew someone was going to betray me to murder me at my dinner table, I mean, I might hand them a piece of food, but I'm going to have dropped it on the floor and like kicked it around a little bit. Here, you want this? You know, I would not be like, hey, here, have the seat of honor right here, you know? And I certainly would not have washed his feet. But Judas took the morsel from Jesus, and the text says, Satan entered him. One commentator said, so the final gesture of affection precipitates the final surrender of Judas to the power of darkness. And actually, John noted in verse 30 that it was nighttime, and in the Gospel of Luke, it says, this is the hour that darkness reigns. None of the disciples could see it, but for just a moment, think about this. Jesus is at the table. Judas hasn't left, but it says, right after Jesus handed him the morsel, Judas, I guess, hardened his heart, the final, 1%, where it was like, whatever questions he had in his heart in that moment, he said, I'm doing this thing. I'm tired of this guy. I'm sick of this guy. I'm going to turn him in. And at that moment, Satan entered him, and none of the disciples could see it, but Jesus was face to face with Satan for just a few moments. And Jesus could have wiped Satan and Judas out. I mean, just ended both of them in that moment. But he chose to surrender himself to this moment out of love for us. That's the picture of Jesus' love for Judas. Secondly, we see the character of Jesus' love is seen in his God-glorifying sacrifice. So when Judas had left, it says, and Judas had left, and the next time they would see Judas would be when Judas brought the Roman soldiers to arrest Jesus, right? So that was it. He's gone. Next time I see him, he's going to be betraying me. So Jesus, verse 31 says, when he had gone out, Jesus said, now is the Son of Man glorified, and God is glorified in him. If God is glorified in him, God will also be glorified, glorify him in himself and glorify him at once. So he's setting up the disciples for the cross. He's saying, listen, this is it, guys. The Son of Man is going to be glorified. I'm going to be glorified. God's going to glorify himself in me. I will be glorified in this moment. Now, of course, they didn't get it. It was like Charlie Brown's teacher, you know, wah, 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 you know. Nobody ever understands, the students did, but we never do, listening to what the teacher says. And that's exactly, the disciples didn't get what he was saying in this moment. Later, John is writing this down out of understanding that this was about the cross. He wanted them to see, this is not Jesus being defeated. This is not Jesus' most unglorifying moment, but Jesus' coronation as king. D.A. Carson, the great theologian, has a great commentary on John. He says, the supreme moment of divine disclosure, the greatest moment of displayed glory, was in the shame of the cross. Nowhere in all creation, all time, reveals the essence of God's character more than the cross. We can debate, we can argue, we can talk, but Scripture, Jesus himself says the cross is it. This is the central reality of the glory of God that we have to behold. Now, we can look at creation, but creation's kind of messy, isn't it? I mean, it's beautiful, but it's also messy. There's hurricanes, tornadoes, there's lions that chase down baby antelope. You know, there's parts of creation where we're like, oh, I hope God's not like that, you know, like a terrible destroying hurricane. But at the same time, so creation, while it reveals a glory, the character of God is revealed in the cross. The greatest glory, greatest display of who God is in the crucifixion, because it's there that we encounter God's attributes, his holiness and his love, his righteousness and his mercy, his justice and his grace, his sovereignty and his humility, his wisdom and his patience. To know God, to try to know God apart from the cross is like trying to know colors apart from opening your eyes. You cannot do it. It is impossible to perceive colors with your eyes closed, and it is impossible to perceive the character of God and who he really is apart from the cross of Jesus Christ. That is why we're called to immerse ourselves in the teachings of the cross. You may wonder, if you're new, why, if you've been here a few weeks, you're like, wow, they keep repeating their core values every Sunday. I mean, is this group kind of not very bright? You've been around, you know that's not true. why do we keep saying it? Why do we keep saying gospel, community, and mission? It's because the cross is it. We as a church have nothing else to offer apart from Jesus. Apart from his crucifixion and his resurrection, we have no hope to offer anyone. We have no hope for ourselves. We have no message that can restore a broken marriage. We have no message that can bring someone who's alienated from God into God's family. We have no message that can help heal someone's shame and their hurt and their brokenness and their guilt and their fear and anxiety apart from the cross of Christ. There is no message apart from that. And it really is that the gospel is what creates community. It brings us into a community and sends us on mission, but it is the gospel that's the center. It's not community and it's not mission. It's the gospel, and the center of the gospel is the cross and resurrection of Christ, where God's glory is seen. If you want to know the love of Christ more, you're not going to get it. I'm for good books. Like, I love good books. Like, read them, read good theological books, but don't ever get away from dwelling on the cross. Reflect on it, study it, have people around you who remind you of it, and speak the truth of the cross into your life. Thirdly, here we see the character of Jesus' love is seen in his relationship to his disciples. This group, if you're picking a world changers organization, you know, you're like, I'm gonna pick 12 guys to change the world. You just wouldn't pick these 12. I mean, you just wouldn't. They weren't the brightest. They weren't the most talented or gifted or, I mean, how many times through the Gospels do they just not get Jesus? I mean, one of my favorite examples of this has to be in the Gospel of Mark. Three successive chapters, right? Chapter 8, chapter 9, chapter 10, in almost the exact same spot in each chapter. It's around verse 30 to 35 in each chapter. Chapter 8, chapter 9, and chapter 10. Each time begins with Jesus explaining to his disciples, hey guys, I'm going to be betrayed into the hands of the religious leaders and scribes, and I'm going to be crucified, I'm going to be killed, and I'm going to rise 3 days later. And three times, what follows tells us where the disciples are. The first time, in chapter 8, verse 31 and following, Peter took Jesus aside and said, hey, buddy, that's not the way Messiahs talk. You're not getting it, buddy. You're bringing in a kingdom. You're not dying. Come on, like, this, you got to bring in your kingdom, right? Like, that's what you're here for. And what does Jesus say? Get behind me, Satan. That's how wrong he was in that moment. It wasn't like, dude, you're kind of misunderstanding things. He's like, no, you are diametrically opposed to everything I'm about in that moment. I would have just been crushed as Peter would have been like, just a puddle in the floor going, I wasn't even close on this. I was so wrong. Jesus called me Satan. And then chapter 9, it happens again. And you know what the disciples do immediately after this? Jesus, we got a question. Which one of us is the greatest? We know you're going to die, but like, you know, hey, which, when it comes down to it, is it Simon? Is it John? Maybe James, you know? And then in chapter 10, James and John listen to Jesus explain he's going to die. And then they go, yeah, but dude, could we sit on your right and left in the kingdom? Three times. I think Mark did this for a reason, like showing us how, and he wasn't one of the 12 disciples, but he was very close with the 12 disciples, and he is like throwing them all under the proverbial bus. They miss it. And Jesus knows, he's washed their feet, he's preparing them for the cross, and he knows just within a few hours, one of them is going to betray him. One of them is probably his best friend is going to deny him. And the rest of them are going to run for the hills. This group, and what does he call them? Verse 33, little children. My little children. That's it. As much as you're like, you're acting like children. No, that's not what he meant. It's a term of endearment. It's a term of love. This is a tender expression of intimacy that Jesus is sharing. Of course, Jesus predicted Peter's denial, and in the same story in the Gospel of Luke told, it says, Jesus said to him, Simon, Simon, behold, Satan demanded to have you. So Satan entered Judas, but Satan also wants to go after the head of the disciples. And he says that he might sift you like wheat. but I have prayed for you that your faith may not fail. In other words, and this is what I mean, like it, and his faith didn't. Because what happened when Peter came under conviction? Did he just run away from God for good? No, it says he went out and wept bitterly. He repented. He didn't leave the disciples. He came back knowing that Jesus still loved him. So we see this beautiful character of Jesus' love and his love for his disciples. And then finally here, we see the character of Jesus' love is seen in the love of his disciples have for one another. This is a crazy declaration. Just as I have loved you, you also are to love one another. The Jews had watered down the Old Testament teaching during this time, the scribes, so that you could kind of love who you wanted to. This is why the whole commandment Jesus gave earlier of love your neighbor as yourself, and they were like, oh yeah, who's our neighbor? You know, like, because they wanted to go, it's the people we like, isn't it, Jesus? Not the people we don't like, not those bad people. We don't have to really love them. And so when Jesus says, love each other as I have loved you, it was scandalous. Because it's, for us, it's easy to love who we want to love and dislike who we want to dislike. That's the default setting of our hearts, by the way. And if I was starting a church, that'd probably be how we do it. Hey, welcome to church. Glad you're here. Look around, feel things out. Go find some people you can love and be friends with. And then just feel free to ignore or not love anyone else here, right? Just do whatever's comfortable for you. Maybe that would be way more attractive. Instead, Jesus commands us to do something radically different. A beautiful but simple command. D.A. Carson, again, in his commentary, he says this, the new command is simple enough for a toddler to memorize and appreciate. Profound enough that the most mature believers are repeatedly embarrassed at how poorly they comprehended and put it into practice. Love one another as I have loved you, so you must love one another. But did you know, as imperfectly as they sought to live this out, the early church sought to live this command out, they began to see fruit from this. This fruit began to be displayed to others. Other people began to see, like, this community's different. It's weird. They seem to really love each other. One early historian around about 100 years after John had written said, see how they love one another, how ready they are to die for one another. Love was the marker of the early church, not perfection. Not by any stretch. Just read Paul's letter, especially 1 Corinthians, or the letters of Revelation. It wasn't that they were perfect, but and honestly, the indictment was often they've left love, right? They've lost their focus on loving God and loving others. But love is to be the marker of the church. I heard a pastor share a few years ago. He said, I did a little survey with about 15 people in my church. I just asked them, how would you say you're growing in your faith on a scale of 1 to 10? And he goes, you know, I got ranges like, oh, I'm maybe a 3, not doing really great right now. Okay, but, you know, not great, struggling. You know, some are 5, just kind of hanging in there. And some were like 7, you know, yeah, I'm feeling kind of close to God. And he said, he wasn't really interested in the answer. He was interested in the follow-up question. With the follow-up question was, what did you use to measure yourself? And he goes, as they all began to unpack why they gave themselves the number they did, not one of them used love as a marker. Not one of them said, you know, I'm really struggling to kind of love other people myself right now. I'm just selfish. I kind of am wanting my own way. I'd say maybe I'm a 3. Or, you know, I'm really growing in my love. God's really just put love in my heart for other people, even people, difficult people, and I'm really just pursuing that. And I'd say maybe I'm a 7. No, you know, it's interesting. He said they said things like, well, I've really, you know, I'm spending more time reading my Bible. I'm praying more. I'm doing this thing or that thing, or I'm listening to more worship music, or I'm trying to pause throughout my day and just pray for a moment. Like, there were activities. And listen, none of those are wrong. I'm not saying we should all stop those and just, you know, focus on love. Practices help build out structure for love in our lives, right? But it's interesting that we would often measure our own spiritual journeys not by do we love like Jesus loved, but by sheer activity. So when you come into this room on Sundays, you're a regular. Do you focus on loving others? Not the people that are easy for you, not the people in your community group that I hope you love them. That's not who Jesus is like. You need to really stretch to love those people in your group. They're so easy for you to get along with. You relate to them so well. You have so much history with them. Just really try to work through and love them anyway, right? No, who are you seeking to love that doesn't fit into your circle? Who are you trying to express the love of Christ to? I'll be honest. If I could initiate one rule with our church, it would be 5 minutes before the service and 10 minutes after the service, you're not allowed to talk to anyone in your friend circle unless you're praying with them. Now, if they're like, I've got a horrible week, hey, you sit down and pray with them. That's awesome. But if you're just going to be talking to like, hey, what are you going to do? Or do we want to go to lunch together? Like, no. Go to lunch afterwards, 10 minutes. Go talk to the person who came by themselves today. Go find that person who's had the worst week of their life and pray for them. Here's the crazy thing. Let the Spirit guide you. What if we came in here in the morning and said, God, would you lead me to a person who just needs to be loved on today in the name of Jesus, who needs to experience your love? Because the truth is, the love that we are sharing is not your love or my love. It is the love of Jesus. In 1 John chapter 2, it says, if you love, you abide in the light. That language is the same as John 15. I am the vine, you are the branches. If you remain in me and I remain in you, you'll bear much fruit. Apart from me, you can do nothing. What do you think the fruit that he's talking about here then is? It's love. Love expressed through your connection with Christ, who is love. So John Piper here, he says, we are not talking here mainly about copying Jesus. We're talking about connecting with Jesus. We're not talking here mainly about imitation. We're talking about participation, demonstration, manifestation. By this, all people will know that you are my disciples if you have love for one another. Not our Bible knowledge, not our morality, not our community group attendance, not our gathering on Sundays, not our not cussing at work, not that we're nice people, right? It is our love for one another, a deep, abiding, growing, sacrificial, self-sacrificing love for each other. Tells the world, by the way, it's not just that, hey, we are disciples, look at us. Disciples were always meant to point to their rabbi, their teacher, by the way that they lived out his teaching. So the truth is, Jesus is saying, by your actions, the whole world will know who I am. By your love for one another. We are the billboard that Jesus has put up in this world to display that love. Paul Tripp says, love is the willing self-sacrifice for the good of another that does not demand repayment or that the person is deserving. Sometimes self-sacrifice looks like whatever the person needs from you in a moment, giving of yourself and just doing that. And sometimes it means agreeing not to still love a person, but to draw boundaries with them and say, I can't go there with you. I can't cross this line. I can't affirm you in this moment and what you think is loving. And I know you're like, well, what do you mean by that? Ask any parent. Ask any parent when a child says, you don't love me because of you're not letting me do X, Y, or Z. That parent can't go, oh my gosh, you're right. I'm not really loving you. Let me give you that thing. No, as a Christian, we've decided we already have what God has said is good and right and holy and pure. And we can long for that for someone even if they don't long for it themselves. And that is the loving thing to do. I close with a text and a quote that I just haven't gotten out of my mind since I read it, but a reminder of 1 Corinthians 13. I pray you'll reflect on it this week. Love is patient and kind. Love is not jealous or boastful or proud or rude. It does not demand its own way. It is not irritable, and it keeps no record of being wronged. It does not rejoice about injustice, but rejoices whenever the truth wins out. Love never gives up, never loses faith, is always hopeful, and endures through every circumstance. And then just as a confession for me this week, Eugene Peterson said this, and I pray this will be a reflection for you as well in confession. There is nothing I am less good at than love. I am far better in competition than in love. I am far better at responding to my instincts and my ambitions to get ahead and make my marks than I am at figuring out how to love another. I am schooled and trained in acquisitive skills and in getting my own way. And yet I decide every day to set aside what I can do best and attempt to do what I do very clumsily. Open myself up to the frustrations and failures of loving, daring to believe that failing in love is better than succeeding in pride. Let's pray. Jesus, we're incredibly grateful that this command to love one another comes with the power to do it. That you yourself, having laid down your life for us while we were yet sinners, to redeem us, to cleanse us, to make us new, to make us whole, to bring us into your family, you have not only displayed that love, you have given that love to us. That love dwells in each and every one of your children in this room. And for those who have never experienced it, I pray that they would use this time, that they would ask Jesus, if you are this loving, would you display that love in me? Would you show it to me? And I pray that you would bring them near through the cross. And for the rest of us who are seeking to live this love out and can hopefully in this moment think of ways we are not doing it, that we would use this time of taking communion, the bread and the cup, to remind ourselves we are not loved because we're good. You are making us good because we are loved. And that we can take this communion knowing we are fully, freely, and forever forgiven. Help us to love like you, Jesus, in your name.